Welcome everyone to Spotlight. We're glad you were able to join us today. Spotlight is a program on For the People, in which we interview a member of our For the People family, learn more about their life and their life experiences. Before we get started, I'd like to thank Start Button for his expertise in recording our Spotlight programs for us for the purpose of archiving. We'll ask that you hold your questions and comments for our guests until the end of the interview. And as usual, remind you that text messaging isn't permitted in this room. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Steve Pallett to introduce his guest for today. Steve?
Thank you, Becky, and welcome to everyone. And once again, it's my pleasure to introduce the guest for Spotlight on this occasion. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Milton Alter, who is joining us relatively early in the morning. I think it's just after 7:30 in the morning where Milton is. Milton, welcome. Can I begin by asking you where and when you were born?
Thank you, Steve. And I'd like to say aloha. That's how we say welcome and greetings from Hawaii. My name is Milton Alter. My screen name is Kona Coffee. And I am located in the state of Hawaii, the city of Honolulu on the island of Oahu. I was born and raised here back in December of 1952 and have lived here all my life. And I am of Japanese extraction. That's my ethnic background. And I am a totally blind person, born legally blind. Had some sight for up until about my age of 14, and then totally, completely lost my sight.
Can you tell us a little bit about your early childhood, about your parents, etc.? What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a warehouseman, pulling stock from the warehouse. He worked in various warehouse operations, and that's what he retired as. My mother was more of like a bookkeeper, office clerk, and they did that throughout their entire working career. My blindness is actually stemmed from rubella, which is in some areas it's known as German measles, and that is how I was born legally blind. Originally, when I was born, I had cataracts, and after about 9 months, received my first eye operation to try and see if they could remove the cataracts. I had total of number of 5 surgeries, 3 on my left and 2 on my right, and my right eye was significantly better than my left.
So, from what you're telling us, Milton, when you were a young child, you had partial sight. How good was your sight? How would you estimate that you could see back in those days?
I could tell the difference between colors, but I could never recognize faces. Of course, I could see big, huge landmarks, so which made bus traveling fairly simple for me, because I could just look for the landmarks that I would normally need to look for. And know when to get off. Never had to ask the bus driver to let me off at a certain stop. Nowadays, when I get on the bus, I do have to let the driver know if I'm going to an unfamiliar area where I need to get off. Other than that, I have learned to get on a bus, and if it's a familiar area, I ride it fairly regularly. I can almost tell when I'm coming up to my stop.
Yeah, I think that's a skill that a lot of blind people develop when they're travelling around. I'm interested in your location, where you're actually living. Just give us a feel for what it was like living in such a beautiful part of the world as a small child. Did you have lots of freedom to wander and do pretty much what you liked, or did you have a protected childhood? What was your early childhood like? Preschool, I'm talking.
don't quite remember that far back, but most of my childhood days growing up, I pretty much had the opportunity to do whatever I wanted to do. My parents were not that protective, only for certain things, I guess, that I could say that they were a little protective of. They were afraid for me to go on my first trip solo to the States from here, and the only way you can get from here to the West Coast now, California, is by air. Not like the olden days when you had the ships come between the West Coast and Hawaii. I did pretty much like what kids used to do, get into trouble. I went to school for my kindergarten year with a bunch of sighted kids, and it was my neighborhood school. Then they discovered that because of the amount of vision I had, I was sent to a school where they had a sight-saving class. That's for students with low vision. At that school, they felt that I should really go to a school for the blind, so they sent me to the what was known at that time Diamond Head School, which is now the Hawaii State Center for the Deaf and Blind. And I spent 2 years there. I learned some Braille there. I learned to get along with the blind kids. At that time, after the second year, there was a change of principal, and he felt that anyone who had any sort of vision really should go back to the sight-saving school. So I was sent back to the sight-saving school for the rest of my elementary school. Went on being mainstreamed to middle school and on to high school, and graduated in 1971 from a school called McKinley High School. It is one of the largest schools in the state of Hawaii.
I'm going to ask you what your have you got any opinions about integrated education as opposed to segregated education when it comes to visually impaired people? I know you were very young at the time when you were at a sighted school, but have you developed any opinions as to which is the best way to go for visually impaired people?
At the stage where things are at right now, my feeling is there should be some time in their school career that they need to be into some kind of a residential program of some sort to develop some basic blind skills before they can be really mainstreamed. At the stage right now where things are, they're mainstreamed right from the start. It's very difficult for a kid to really learn blind skills and to be among blind people and know how to live like a blind person.
Very valid points. I tend to agree with you. It's not my opinions we're talking about, of course, but I do tend to agree with that. Being away or learning blind skills is very important. Can we just take you back to your school years just for a little while longer, Milton, and I'd be interested to know which subjects you particularly enjoyed at school. Is there any area in which you felt that you excelled in, that you felt, I really enjoy this and I could really make something of myself doing this?
During my entire school year, I really had no favorite subject. I had a difficult time with a lot of subjects, partly I think it might be because of struggling to learn to read, reading with the vision that I did have up until the age of 14, then having to transition to relearn my Braille skills again, and then from there struggling through high school, you know, utilizing my Braille and my travel skills, which I was taught in a very short period of time because of the loss of my sight. I did end up going to a community college and on to the University of Hawaii, where I majored in general music. I had a choice going into various areas, and I ended up choosing general music because that was where primarily my interest was from the years during high school and to my early years of college. I also played in a rock and roll band. I do play various instruments. One of them was the first that I really started taking formal lessons in was the accordion. That's what kind of really got me going into a rock and roll band, and using my accordion in a rock and roll band made it very unique. Who would use an accordion in a rock and roll band? And of course I had all this amplification equipment and whatnot, and it was just something unique, and we got around to a lot of places, and people admired us for what we were doing. We also had a very unique situation because some of the guys in the group were all totally blind as well.
Interesting. We'll come on to that in a little while, but I just want to press you about your school career and to find out from you how you reacted to losing your sight. Did you find it very traumatic? How did you cope from having a little bit of vision to, from what I understand, no vision? Was that a trauma for you, and how did you manage to handle it?
During my time when I was attending the sight-saving school, I was among other sight-saving kids. Most of them were all partials. Some of them could see better than I could. Some of them could not. During my middle school years, again, I was with some partials, and that's where I encountered meeting the totally blind, so the adjustment was fairly smooth. It was not like a real traumatic experience. I knew that I was beginning to have some vision problems, and so I was compensating for it and adjusting to the situation. It really, the toughest part was actually relearning skills that I had learned in my very early years and getting them to really be part of me, because this is the way how I'm going to have to live for the rest of my life.
Yes, quite. That's understandable. Now, you went to university to study music, and you majored in music. When did your interest in music begin? When did you first realize that you maybe wanted to pursue music as a career?
Probably after I went from the community college up to the university, I had to make some decision as to what I was going to major in. I was leaning toward first becoming a psychology major. At one point, I even thought of becoming an economics major. I was encouraged by a economics instructor that's a possibility that I could go into because I had such a good analytical mind. But I ended up choosing music, I guess, because I was still so involved with music, and I still am involved in music. I've been playing for the church that I regularly attend now for 23 years, and I am the organist there. I play every Sundays for the services on Sundays. I also play other instruments like the guitar, and of course I still play the accordion once in a while. The guitar I use for a ministry that our church runs in the city of Honolulu to feed the homeless. And one of the things that we have to do with that program is run a half an hour service with 15 minutes of music and 15 minutes of preaching. And my role is in that 15 minutes time to go and accompany the song leader for the music, and in some cases, because the room is divided into two parts separated by a kitchen, we end up doing a whole half an hour's worth of music. And so I really work myself to keep the music going there and get them to really sing and give praises unto the Lord.
It's been a very, very good, Milton. I'm sure it's much appreciated, your musical talent. Are you interested in the classics at all, classical music, or you said you played in a rock band? Do you have an interest in classical music too?
Yes, I do. In fact, the music program is based around all classical music from the very Renaissance to the modern age. I got into the general music with the majoring in the instrument of keyboards, and the primary instrument I was using for the keyboards was the piano. And I had a very good piano instructor while attending the music program. So I did fairly well there until toward the end, when pieces that I was playing was beginning to get much more difficult. And I was really struggling there to get those pieces played. I've never owned a piano in my whole life. I had only a 60-key keyboard, electronic keyboard, but that really didn't cut the mustard for like a full-size 88-key keyboard.
Understood. So after you left university, after you'd majored in music, were you able to find employment as a musician?
No, I've never been able to find employment as a musician. In fact, my whole career has gone in a totally different direction. Maybe almost 6 months after I graduated from school, I was hired by the paratransit company that was started up here in Hawaii to be their dispatcher. And I did that for about 5 months or so, working 9 vehicles on the road with a two-way radio, and at the same time answering the phones from 6 o'clock in the morning to like about 4:30 in the afternoon. And I had some good office staff working with me. Those days we had no computers, everything was being done by hand, so someone was reading the dispatch log back to me and doing all the writing for all the log keeping that had to be done. Taking the reservations and answering the phones, I did that with a braille writer, and then I would dictate all the information back to one of the girls late in the afternoon to start putting it all into the log for the following day's set of pickups.
So was this a form of taxi service? Did people ring and request a pickup? I'm just trying to work out exactly what the transit job was. Was it taxis or not?
We were using modified vehicles. These were specially designed vehicles for wheelchairs, and we also carried the blind and visually impaired and physically challenged individuals. Some of them were retarded that were, I guess you would call them non-educable people. And we carried dialysis patients to their dialysis treatment and things like this. Booking had to be done 24 hours in advance, and if you call the same day, we take you only on space availability. Our policy was that if we carried you and you had no pickup for your return trip, if you called us from wherever you were, we pick you up. But if you just call out of the blue and wanted us to pick you up, we tell you that we'll pick you up, providing we can squeeze a van by to get you and to make the drop-off on you. So we tell them to call back periodically because we cannot promise them anything. We had to take care of our regular customers and those that went out with us from the morning and we're waiting for them to make the return trip.
You said a few minutes back that you did this job for a few months. What happened after that, Milton? What's the next stage in your very interesting story?
I was unemployed then for a little more than a year and a half. At that time, then the Voc Rehab Agency decided that, hey, it's time to go get, at that time, what was known as the Opticon. There may be some out there that know what the Opticon is. It's a tactile reading device that reads print. And so they sent me to the company Telesensories Incorporated at that time, which was located in Palo Alto, California. I spent 2 weeks there in California for the Opticon training. Upon returning, we further pursued employment, and at that time, around that time, I guess, the person that had the Braille proofreading job with the State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped here retired, and so there was an opportunity to apply for a position there. At the time, though, that they were in the process of rewriting the job description to more modernize the position description. In 1980, I was employed with the State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped as a Braille proofreader. At that time, I was also taking the correspondence course for certification as a Braille proofreader, and I had obtained my certification in 1984. as a B-class certification, which does not require me to do any of the corrections. It's just mainly to do the proofreading and produce a report. That's where I am at now. I've been working now for the State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped as this Breathless proofreader for 23-plus years now.
Tell us about the actual process of being a Braille proofreader, what you actually do on a daily basis. Does this material come to you on loose leaf Braille? How does it actually work, and what is your actual job? What do you do on a day-to-day basis? Do you have to read the whole text, or do you just take a sample of it?
We'll go back a bit. When I first started doing proofreading, everything was being done by hand using the Perkins Brailler. We had a small group at that time when I first started of Brailless. We were running some classes through an adult education program, which was like a night school for people who wanted to become Braille transcribers and to become Braille transcribers as volunteers. We developed a small group of about up to maybe 8-9 people or so, including myself, working with them and helping them to further develop their skills once they completed the course. And the course was very structured. Each week that they went to class, they went to class twice a week, they had to accomplish and complete one lesson, because it was laid out such in the book that there were 18 lessons, and you split them up in 9 lessons in the first semester and 9 lessons in the second. And after the 9 lessons, they could volunteer for us and at the same time begin to prepare their manuscript, their 35 pages, to receive their certification from the Library of Congress. Today we do a lot of our Braille transcribing using the computer. The program that we use at the library is MegaDots. We're running it on a Windows system, and we have a high-speed Braille embosser that we do all our embossing with. Those days, of course, when we did single sheets, we had to thermoform all our copies, so I spent a lot of time making duplicates. Today, because there are a number of people that are able to get their materials in Braille very easily using Braille translators and Braille embossers, and there are various people around town and on the mainland that have gone into doing Braille transcription work, we hardly do heavy amounts of Braille transcribing at the library. So a lot of my time is spent duplicating tapes, usually the damaged cassette books from the NLS collection, to put them back into circulation. A lot of times we get broken tapes, tapes that get jammed in the cassette players, and things like that. So we duplicate the books and make good copies of the tape to put the books back into circulation as quick as we can.
So you've diversified into audio production as well. But I'm still interested in the actual job as a Braille proofreader. You have this text in front of you. Do you have to read it from start to finish to find any errors, or do you just take samples of the text periodically through the document? And what do you do when you do find an error? Because you said that you didn't actually correct the error, so how do you indicate that an error has occurred?
Our method here that we use for proofreading from the time I have started working for the library has been to read the book from a cover to cover, word for word. We look at the format and structure of the Braille copy. We look for every single error that we can find, whether it's typographical, whether it is Brailling error, whether it's ghost dots, misused contractions, basically even the formatting errors. If we got a problem, we let the Braillists know that they need to fix the entire Brailling error. I produced all my reports at the first time when I first started with reading. And our reading method here we use is I use a volunteer sighted reader. to follow along with the printed text, so that way we can do a comparison to see that nothing is really, really missing. Most of our books that we do, and we still do them, is mainly textbooks, and we follow the textbook formatting code as our guideline for Braille formatting. Like I said, we read the material from cover to cover those days, and I still do some reporting, do some correspondence instructions now for Braille proofreading for people that are out here in Hawaii because of the distance between Hawaii and the Library of Congress, and the Library of Congress has given me authorization to do a correspondence course out here for some of the people that want to take it through directly through me. The reports now are no longer produced because we do all our Braille proofreading with the computer. I use an 80-cell Navigator Braille display. Again, we're still using the method of working with a sighted volunteer. I'll correct the text right there with the computer. If it's really a big problem and I am not sure exactly how to fix the problem, it goes back then to the person that did the inputting for the coding and formatting to see if we can work together to figure out what the problem is and fix the coding so that you get proper Braille and proper Braille formatting.
Can private individuals in the within the islands, blind individuals, request that something is Braille? Could someone request a manual of some description or the instructions for a piece of equipment? Or is it mainly for big organizations and educational authorities that you undertake this work?
Occasionally we get other state agencies requesting materials to be put into Braille, but yes, individuals can request materials to be transcribed into Braille. We've done a number of individual requests for manuals. We're in the process of, for the last couple of years now, been doing the scriptural readings for a young man. I call him young, he's older than I am, for his church work that he's involved in. Of course, with Braille translators, I even do some Braille transcribing myself. We have someone that inputs some material for us, and what I do is I take it in, I translate it, and I punch it out all at work. We also have a Braille embosser at home. I should mention that I am married. My wife is also totally blind. She works with another lady, and they have a Braille transcribing business, and they use the Duxbury program. For our Brailing embossing here, right in our home, we have a VersaPoint Duo. And on the side now, for now the last about 10 years, I've been working with a dealer. We started out with the Arkenstone products, mainly was the Open Book. We moved over to Ruby and back now to Open Book with Freedom Scientific. I work as an associate dealer out here in Hawaii for the dealer that is actually based in Washougal, Washington, the state of Washington. We cover the area of Oregon and the southern part of Washington State, all of Hawaii, and the South Pacific. That is all our territory. We cover products for Humanware, Freedom Scientific, AI Square, Telesensory, and a couple of other companies that we do represent. So I do have these various products here sitting all on my computer.
And in our pre-interview chat, you told me that you actually go out and install product for clients. Is that correct? Tell us a little bit about that, Milton. It sounds interesting.
Yes, actually I got started in all of this with a request from one of the neighbor islands. Hawaii is, by the way, comprised of six major islands. Two of them are islands that are one right now being restored, and the other is a private island which you can only go via permission from the owners of the island, but the whole island chain consists of eight islands. Well, anyway, I had a call from one of the neighbor islands asking about scanning systems, and it was from a 90-year-old lady who wanted to buy a reading machine for her home, and they had asked me what did I think about various products. I says, well, I'm going to tell you, I don't necessarily tell you that this is the product that you should get. I tell you that this is what I've seen in a report. And the report at that time that I had seen was one that came out in the Braille Monitor reviewing the two reading machines at that time, which were the Kurzweil Reading Edge and the Arkenstone system, which was the Open Book at that time. And Arkenstone had a standalone reading machine. And I told them that I thought that the Arkenstone Open Book package was probably a better package put together overall. And so the lady decided that she wanted to go and buy one of those units. She had a chance to try one out over on the island that she lived on. And in the meantime, I had already purchased a system myself. Mainly, I started out with just a scanner and the software because I already had the computer. I ended up installing it on my system, saying how great a success I also had with it. And in the meantime, this lady ended up purchasing the unit, not knowing who would come out to help her put it together and make sure that everything was working correctly. And when they had been contacting me, they asked, would you be able to come out to Kauai, which is the name of the island that she was on, to actually test this and put this thing together for her to make sure everything was working. I says, well, if somebody would pay my airfare, because that's the only way you can get to the outer island, I'd be glad to come over and put it together. So in the meantime, they didn't know how they were going to find the money to pay me for that, because it's not cheap flying between islands. I called back the company. I talked to some people. They put me in touch with the vice president of the company at that time, which was Mike May. Some of you may have heard of him. He's the pioneer in talking GPS systems. And he's now the founder of a company called Sendero Corporation, Sendero Group, that it's better known as. And they've come out with a talking GPS package that actually runs on the Braille note that's being sold through the Humanware. Anyway, Mike and I started talking back and forth. He ended up saying, well, look, the lady already purchased it. We already shipped out the stuff. Why don't you go on over, make your reservations, go on over, fly over to Kauai, arrange for somebody to pick you up at the airport to take you out to this lady's place, we'll pay for it. Just send us all the receipts. So I ended up doing that and took off, and 2 weeks later I was on the island, spent a day there, put the system together, and flew back to Honolulu. And that's where it all started. Mike May had a friend that is the dealer that I work with, living on one of the outer islands, and he made contact with him and talked him into becoming the Arkenstone dealer at that time, and after that we have expanded from there.
Excellent. Absolutely excellent, and I'm sure you do a first-rate job. You're a very busy man, Milton. I don't know how you fit it all in. And now I'd like to move on to your further involvement in helping visually impaired and partially sighted people in the islands, because I know that you're very involved in running several websites. Now tell us about your involvement with A, your own website, and B, other websites which you help to coordinate and keep on the road.
Yes, as part of getting involved into the internet and computers, my internet provider was offering 5 megabytes of hard drive space to set up a web page if you wanted to utilize that space. And I saw an article that came out in Voice of Vision, which is a newsletter that's put out by GW Micro. They had a series of articles on HTML coding, and so I got interested. I followed the story. I followed some of the coding instructions that they had, and I said, I'm going to try and build my own website. So I contacted my internet provider. I got the web space set up. I found programs that I needed to use for web page editing and an FTP client that was much easier than using the one that's in Windows, and actually got my own web page going. It web address, if any of you are interested in visiting it, it's http://, that's the forward slash, www.h, as in hotel, g as in golf, e as in echo, a as in alpha, .org. You need another forward slash, a tilde, which is the shift and the accent key, M as in Michael, O as in Oscar, T as in Tango, A as in Alpha. I have a website up there. It's chock full of information. It's a very, very accessible website. It will read with any screen reader that you go up there with. It's a very simple website and very easy to navigate. I've done a bunch of stuff there. I've even got a photo album that I, what I've done is had friends help me scan pictures, and using the web editor that I use, it ends up putting in the actual scripting and sizing for the actual photos that actually get displayed. I got into this as just a fun thing. Now the website has grown to be a very monstrosity thing to maintain of my own, and that's a part of my own doing. And in the meantime, I was involved with my local affiliate to the American Council of the Blind, and American Council of the Blind was offering web space for hosting your local affiliate on the web. So I put up a web page for the local affiliate, which is the Hawaii Association of the Blind. I then became a member of the Visually Impaired Data Processors International, known as VIDPI. I am their webmaster, and I manage that particular website. I offered to do a web page for the American Blind, American Council of the Blind Lions. They also have a web page. That one is a very simple one-pager. And I just recently picked up a new one from the Iowa Council of the United Blind. The page was already up, but they needed somebody to update the site and maintain it. So that's what I am doing now. I'm in the process of maintaining their website, and we're doing some updating at the present time right now. We've got the bulletins all up to date. We're putting up the resolutions. I've got to go fix the graphics on one of the pages and do a few more things to the whole website, and then work will be completed to date. That's where I am now with web developing and web design. I've been in doing some consulting work also for some people in checking their website to see that it is very accessible to a point that it will work with the screen readers. And that's where I am now with to work with the web.
Again, congratulations, Milton. You're an inspiration. We'll ask you to give the URL again afterwards. I'm sure people would want to take note of it, and maybe at the end of the interview we could arrange for you to give us the URL again, or even type it into the room window so that people can have a record of it and be able to go straight to your website if they have Steve's scripts. But we'll ask you at the end of the interview again to give the URL of your own website. When we do visit the website, you said it was you know, chock-a-block of interesting information. What sort of things are we going to find on it? What sort of links can we expect to see?
The very first link you will see is actually a reference to website that actually there's some JavaScripting that actually comes up in text, and it's the verse of the day. It changes every 24 hours automatically from another server from the International Bible Society. Then you will have a link that will take you to my ISP or my internet provider's website. Then you'll have a bunch of links to some of the various pages that I actually have on my own personal website. Then you'll find some links for the web pages that I do servicing for. You'll then have a bunch of links to some of my favorite spots Of course, you'll have a link going to the American Council of the Blind and ACB Radio. And the Lions International, because I do belong to the local Lions Club here. In fact, I'm trying to work out with a guy right now. I've got a bunch of pictures that of myself and my involvement with the Lions Club, and we're going to try and see if we can put a PowerPoint display of these pictures up onto the web. And that's yet to still be worked out. I've got to work it out with a guy to scan the pictures and get it put into PowerPoint. I have also joined the Web Blind Ring. It's a web ring of websites run, owned, or operated by blind people. And I'm a part of that ring. Most of the websites that I do maintain are also part of that ring. And then I have some private links down at the bottom just for my personal use, so that if I'm at another remote location and I wanted to get to a particular site, it'd be no problem getting there from the web page. I have a fantastic resource list of over 450 plus links to various vendors, organizations, service organizations, you name it, mostly to do with the blind and visually impaired. If you ever want the most comprehensive list to take you somewhere, or you're looking for a vendor, or you're looking for a particular product, looking for some particular information, I do have the link, but I do not have descriptions of the organizations. All you'll get is the link that will take you to the organization. And I ask that if you do find a broken link, that you let me know with the email link that's somewhere on the web page. That's basically what the website consists of, is some stuff that I put up and gathered together over the years since I've had this website up.
Sounds like an absolutely splendid resource, Milton, and of course we'll get you to repeat the URL for us at the end of the interview. In case I forget, will somebody please kick me and remind me, but I don't think I'll forget because it's so important. We'll get you to give that again at the end of the interview. Can we now move on and talk about visually impaired people in Hawaii and the islands in general? What sort of provision is made for VI people in your part of the world? Are they good, or is there room for improvement?
There's definitely a lot of room for improvement. We have a vocational rehabilitation program under the Department of Human Services, which is really a branch. It's the Department of Human Services has several divisions. The vocational rehabilitation is under one of those divisions. But the vocational rehabilitation program for the blind is just a branch. So it's a very small program here. Library system is not under the Department of Human Services. It is under the Department of Education, under the state library system. The library system is like a division. And we operate as a branch. We are located just on the outskirts of the tourist spot of Hawaii, which is known as Waikiki. And we are completely at an opposite end of town from the Voc Rehab program. Voc Rehab program, because we are separated by islands, majority of its services are done from Oahu. They do have Voc Rehab counselors on every island. But library services mainly is from Oahu, with machine sublending agencies on the outer islands. I do not handle any of the circulation work. We approximately estimate that there's around about 3,000 plus blind and visually impaired people in the islands. And don't ask me if I know that many people, because I really don't. I know only a handful of them, and we have two blindness organizations that are present here. the National Federation of the Blind and the American Council of the Blind, and we have affiliates for them here.
Can we just take one of those subjects you spoke about, and that's mobility? If someone wanted mobility training in Hawaii, would it be long cane training, or are they able to accommodate people with seeing eye dogs, or guide dogs as we'd call them over here in the UK?
O&M instructions is done through the Vocational Rehabilitation Services. They have two mobility instructors. Both of them do have schedules that they have to keep with the agency, but they also offer to do on-site O&M training, which stands for Orientation and Mobility, by the way, to the Outer Islands, and they go upon a request of the individual. There is a guide dog program here. It's a nonprofit organization called Eye of the Pacific Guide Dog and Mobility Aids, and they have supplied at least one person that I know of with a laser cane, and they were bringing in guide dogs from Australia and New Zealand because of the quarantine situation. Recently, Hawaii has relaxed its quarantine regulations for service animals and guide dogs, and now if you properly get the vaccinations and paperwork done prior to entering in the state of Hawaii, you can bring your guide dogs over and not be restricted for the quarantine of 120 days. Other type of animals still have to go through at least a 30-day quarantine. The guide dog program here, we're providing guide dogs to no cost whatsoever to the individual, and mobility services are provided at no cost to the individual as well. The schools have their own O&M instructors to teach mobility skills to the kids attending school. So that's not really a part of the division's vocational rehab program for the blind.
Do you have any residential centres where people can go and live daily living skills after they've lost their sight? Because I'm assuming that, like the world over, probably the majority of blind people are elderly. I know it's the case over here in the UK. I just wondered if there's provision for getting people away from their home environment just for a short period to learn daily living skills, or is that something that you hope to set up in the future?
The Voc Rehab Agency mainly brings in people from the Outer Island, and they put them up in a hotel. They at one time tried doing a live-in type of program, renting a house, but it got too big of an expense for them to carry liability insurance. I understand that the agency is looking now to building their own facility, a live-in facility at the agency itself. I think what they're waiting for now is funds to do the renovation and furnish the units that will be used for the live-in. Other than that, we do not have any kind of a residential program for either the schools or the Voc Rehab program here in Hawaii.
Would you say that there's a healthy lobbying movement within the visually impaired in Hawaii to improve facilities?
It's interesting that you asked that question. That's the reason why they're doing this renovation. The Hawaii program has chosen to model its program around the Iowa Department for the Blind, which was at one time known as the Iowa Commission for the Blind, which was taken over and run by Kenneth Jernigan for a period of time of, I think it was almost about 12 years. At that time, Jernigan built up one of the best rehab programs in the nation, and there are now about a good half a dozen programs across the country that have modeled themselves against or around the Iowa program. Well, Hawaii is choosing to model itself around the Iowa program as well. This is where the change is now taking place. The change takes a while. It's expected to take probably maybe a good 7 years to actually complete the full changeover.
Yes, it's probably going to be a long, gradual process, but well worth it in the end. Now, we're sort of approaching maybe the end of the interview now, Milton, so I'd like to find out a little bit about what you do when you're not involved in all this great work you're doing for visually impaired people in the islands. What do you do in your leisure time, if you do indeed have any leisure time?
Occasionally, I'll sit back and watch a descriptive video with my wife in front of the entertainment center that we have. Other times, maybe pull up a talking book and sit back and do some reading. But other than that, it's very little time that I have spared. In fact, after I get off of this interview, I have to finish getting ready and go out to go fix a computer with a guy. This guy's been having some trouble with his scanning scanner and his scanning program, and we're doing some upgrading on his computer. So we're headed for that this morning. Other than that, don't really do much. My time is pretty well occupied from day to day with various things to do.
And out of all these activities which you've partaken in since your school days, which are you most proud of? What would you say is your greatest achievements so far?
Gee, I don't know what I can call something that I have achieved. It's things that just I do, and I am almost like a jack of all trades, but a master at none. So I can't really say that any one particular thing highlights any other over the other, or whatever you want to call it. I do enjoy playing around with the computer a whole lot. And so I spend a lot of time, of course, in front of my computer just tinkering with it, tweaking it and stuff like that.
And where would you like to see provision for blind people have reached maybe in 10 years? What are your hopes and aspirations for the next 10 years?
Gee, I haven't looked that far ahead. I'm looking for my own personal retirement from the state of Hawaii, looking at retirement probably in about 5 years from now, getting out and not sure what I'm going to be doing after that.
But hopefully still playing your Hammond organ, which I know you're particularly fond of. We spoke about it on our pre-interview, and I know you're very fond of the Hammond organ.
Yes, I love the sound of a Hammond organ. I used to own a Spinet model when I was playing in the rock and roll band, and when I found the church had one, they have actually an organ that I'm keeping going right now, which is over 50 years old. It's one of the oldest Hammond organs still working in the state of Hawaii. I keep talking to the guy that services the organ for us, and he says, in a couple of years we're going to run out of parts. I don't know if I can still service this thing. You guys might have to look for another organ. I says, no, you're going to fix this thing because I like that sucker.
Yeah, that's a great sound. I agree with you there. Is there any other aspect of your life or any other experience or philosophical point about your take on blindness that you'd like to share with us just before we finish?
Well, about 10 years ago, I was very inspired after attending my first national convention and been attending a national convention, which is the American Council of the Blind, since 1992. And have only missed, actually, I think, one convention since then. And we missed the convention that was in Louisville, Kentucky, in the year 2000. Got married in 1999 of September, and so my wife and I made plans, because of all her family was not able to make the wedding, to go visit her family back in the state where she came from, which is North Dakota. That's originally where my wife was born and raised. So that summer we made a trip to North Dakota to meet the rest of the family. Since then, we've been back every year since we've been married to see the family, because sometimes there's somebody that we miss or we didn't get to see back when we go back home. I love to travel. This year, in fact, because we missed the convention in the year 2000 in Louisville, Kentucky, we're going to also go to Louisville and Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're going to attend the ACB and the NFB convention this summer. NFB convention mainly because we've been invited by some friends of the NFB to go there to see their convention. It does not conflict with the ACB convention in terms of scheduling. So it works out pretty perfect that we'll be able to do 2 weeks on the mainland, all on the East Coast for attending these conventions. Like I say, I love to travel, and I think that that's the greatest thing. If any blind persons need inspiration, you've got to go to one of these conventions, because you've got exhibits there that it's like a total marketplace where you can find every vendor that you can think of that's dealing with blindness and low vision products and services. And of course, at the American Council of the Blind Convention, the vendors are allowed to sell in the exhibit hall, so you can purchase things right there. And that's one of the reasons why I try to make it, to go see the vendors, see what's new. I've made a lot of contacts there. I've got a lot of friends now since going to the convention now for over 10 years. So if any of you have never been to a national convention, you really need to make plans to attend.
Sounds like a great thing. We have a similar thing over here in the UK, trade shows, etc. But I know that these conventions in the States are great occasions where you all, you know, get together and have a fantastic time. As promised, I'm going to ask you to once again repeat the URL of your own website, and if you could put it in the window for us, if you could actually write it in the room, you know, write it on the keyboard and press enter, it should actually come up in the room for people so that they can actually take a copy of the URL. But if you give it to us verbally, that would be also helpful. Just could you do that for us, Milton?
Okay, I did put it in the window. I'm not sure if everyone can pick it up. Here's the address once again. It's http://www.hgea.org/, you need the tilde symbol, and MOTA. There is also a link there from the website that you can also send me email if you wish to. My email address for somebody who may just want to even write it down right now, it's M as in Michael, O as in Ota, T as in Tango, A as in Alpha, @ hgea.org. You can send me email at that address or go to the website and send me email from there as well. Thank you. I'd like to thank for the people and Steve Pallett for the opportunity to share in this interview. And I hope that it's been an inspiration to those of you who are out there. If anybody has any questions very quickly, I'd be glad to take some questions right now.
I'd also like to thank you very much indeed for a fantastic interview. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'd also like to thank Becky for her coordination of Spotlight, and of course to Dennis for his recording of Spotlight. From my point of view, it makes life a lot easier. Okay, any questions for Milton before he dashes off to continue his work helping another blind person with a computer? So any questions for Milton, fire now.
Are there any more questions?
Yes. Will you please repeat that email address? I don't know about your other people out there in the radio land, but I can hardly hear you. I can hear the gentleman from the UK all right, but I can't hear you, friend from Hawaii. Over and out.
Okay, I'm going to type the email address into the window, see if you can pick it up from there. Okay, that email address is mota@hgea.org.
Okay, thank you. I'm in Florida. Roy, over and out.
Thanks very much again, Milton. Great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Milton. Great interview. Two great guys. Really enjoyed it.
It was a super interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very interesting. We want to thank everyone for coming today, and we hope you'll join us here next Saturday for Spotlight. And Tech Tiger will be in the spotlight.